Hi. Good morning, everyone. I see people are still walking in, but I'm afraid we have to begin. Well, my name is Krishnan. I'm with Microsoft. Been with Microsoft for about 4 years now. And today's talk is going to be about C-Sharp, what's coming out at C-Sharp 4.0, but also a little bit of a look into the future, what's coming out at C-Sharp 4.0. So that's going to be the agenda of today. There will be plenty of demos. For those of you who probably have seen me present last year, I love to type in code on the fly. I don't like using code templates. So the chances are things will go wrong. So at least if you guys work as IntelliSense and background compile features, then I should be good to go. All right. At least with regard to questions, I'll save those for the end of the talk. So, but if you have really pressing questions, then feel free to interrupt me. All right, like I said, the agenda for today is to give you an idea of the evolution of C-Sharp, where C-Sharp came from, where it's going, and some of the things that we're looking for in at least the versions that are going to come after C-Sharp 4. All right. Not many people realize, but it's actually just over 10 years that C-Sharp was first released. At least in 1998, there was a design team formed within Microsoft for the first language release. And of course, it was released a bit later on. But essentially, the first release was the first version of the managed code runtime. C-Sharp 2.0 was essentially, again, a release where we didn't get a chance to do too many things in 1.0 because of time constraints. So 2.0 was essentially going back and filling in the blanks, which is what we did. And a big feature in C-Sharp 2.0 was generics. But C-Sharp 3.0, and with the introduction of language-integrated query, actually gave Microsoft the first chance to go and do something fundamentally different in the language. This gave us a little bit of time as well. The first two releases took up an enormous amount of time and resources. And of course, language integrated query. Just a show of hands, how many of you use Link here? Okay, everyone. Good. Well, I'm not going to go too much into language integrated query. That's, well, over and done with. But at least today, you're not here to see much of Link, but what's coming in C-Sharp 4.0. So just to talk a little bit about the trends that influenced C-Sharp 4.0, there are three primary trends that influenced C-Sharp 4.0. One is the declarative style of programming. I'll talk a little bit about this in the upcoming slides. Also the influence that dynamic languages and dynamic runtimes have had on C-Sharp. And also the trends in hardware with regard to concurrency and how languages have to deal with those. So these are the three primary trends that influenced C-Sharp 4.0 and the .NET 4.0 runtimes. Now to talk a little bit about declarative programming, this is primarily what language-integrated query is about. Normally, as we developers tend to write code, what we tend to do is we tend to over-specify the problem. That is, there's a problem, we need to come up with a solution. And of course, the solution is over-specified if you look at the code. If you look at the code, there's a whole lot of, I wouldn't call it junk. You have to declare variables, you have to initialize them, you have your for loops, your while loops, you have to enumerate data structures like lists, dictionaries, hash tables, what have you. And when you take a piece of code and when you look at it, it's very hard to go back and figure out what the hell was the guy thinking when he wrote this? I mean, what is he trying to do out here? So, our programs, at least in the past, have been an excruciating amount of detail, not just what the problem is and how it should be solved, but also the how part is also in a great amount of detail. And the how part tends to have a lot of noise associated with it. The how part takes the majority of the chunk of code rather than the what you're trying to achieve. The what is probably your method name and probably a couple of lines of code within there. But the how part accounts for a significant chunk of code. And from a compiler perspective, the JIT compiler, of course, tries to go through your code and optimize certain things. But of course, when there's so much noise in the code, when you're newing up variables, you're creating dictionaries, you're putting things in dictionaries, you're having your loops, it's hard for the JIT compiler to take a look at the code and figure out what was your intent, what were you trying to do. And that's also where language integrated query came in, where it let the developer work at a higher level of abstraction, where the developer would have to work with the what and not necessarily specify how things have to be done. If you take a typical link query, you just essentially specify what has to be done. Just to kind of give you a quick demo, I said this wouldn't be about C# 3.0, but just to give you a quick overview of what is possible, what I'm going to do out here is just write a simple query which goes through all of the types in the string class where the method in the string class is not a static. It's an instance method. So in order to write this piece of code, it's actually as simple as that, or I would just say for each methods, console, write line, n. Now this very simple program, if you look at it, it's pretty obvious what it does. Even my girlfriend, who's completely non-technical, could pretty much read this line of code. And what that does is it goes and prints out all of the methods in the string class. And now if you want to do something a little bit more complex, where you kind of want to sort everything, you don't have a quick sort algorithm or any other sorting algorithm, you just kind of specify an order by clause. And the beauty of it is, you now get an ordered list as a result. So from a developer's perspective, when you're developing at a higher level of abstraction, if you take a look at this, you just specify what has to be done. You never tell the runtime how things have to be done. You don't specify that the order by has to use a particular sorting algorithm. But the advantage of programming at this level is that it gives the compiler a whole lot more room to perform optimizations. So, for example, if the compiler notices that all you're doing is selecting data and you have multiple processes, then maybe the compiler can run the query on multiple processes, which is actually what a whole lot of .NET 4 does. It doesn't do it automatically, but we'll take a look at those as we go on. And of course, you can also do a whole lot of pretty complex things out here. If I wanted to figure out all of the methods which have a number of overloads, I can kind of say group m dot name into group, and then I would say select. I'm giving up an anonymous type up here where I would say the method is the group dot key, and the overload count equals group dot count. And if I now run this piece of code, you get to see that I print out all the methods and the number of overloads. But nowhere have I done low-level programming. When I say low-level programming, I've never used up a dictionary, I've never put in items in the dictionary, kind of filter out for duplicates, trying to count the number of items. But programming at this level, like I said, gives the compiler a whole lot more freedom to perform optimizations. Now, C# and Visual Basic .NET have been statically typed languages. How many of you have dabbled around in IronPython or Ruby on Rails? Or No one. Everyone wants it to be into the static type of languages. Well, dynamic languages are becoming increasingly popular with the success of languages, frameworks, whatever you prefer to call them, like Python, Ruby on Rails. And these happen to be dynamic languages. And historically, there's kind of been this clash between statically typed camps and dynamically typed camps. But the reality is that both camps are right. There are good features in both worlds. And it's not right to kind of snicker at the other side and say, well, you know, you guys, yeah, you don't have compile down safety, you don't have refactoring, you don't have all of the other things, so, well, you guys suck. But the bottom line is that there are good features in both the dynamic languages and the static languages. And C# 4.0 has been influenced quite a bit by the functionality provided by dynamic languages. Right, coming to concurrency, if we look at the trends in hardware over the last 2 to 3 years, with Moore's Law, Moore's Law is still in effect. That is, you kind of tend to see that the transistor density in CPUs tends to double every 1.5 to 2 years. And until about 3 years ago, it was true that every time the transistor density doubled up, the clock speeds would also double. But over the last 2 or 3 years, they've kind of hit a wall with regard to the clock speeds. So clock speeds have stayed pretty constant while transistor densities have doubled. And this means that today we're not getting faster processors, but we're getting more processors. Now, your typical laptop, if it has been purchased in the last 1.5 or 2 years, the chances are it's a dual-core machine. And quad-core is pretty much the standard today. And there are now 8-core processors being developed by Intel and AMD. Now, what does all of this have to do with software? Well, the bottom line is, if you're not getting faster processors, but you're getting more processors, then somehow the onus is on the developer to kind of write your programs in such a manner that you can take advantage of multiple processors. And that's a whole lot of stuff which with C# 4.0 and the .NET 4.0 runtime provide. To give you a quick overview of the concurrency side of things, what I have out here, some of you might have seen this demo in the past, is a ray tracer. Arguably, it makes heavy use of the CPU, which might not be true for typical line of business applications, but to just kind of give you an idea of what this particular piece of code does. If you look at the code on screen, you can see that it's an enormous link query which does the bulk of the work in rendering a scene. Now, to just show you what this looks like, what it does is it renders each row and then, well, outputs it on screen. But all of this is computed line by line. And you saw that when I ran it, well, kind of did things one by one. And you see that the time for execution is somewhere close to 6.5, 7 seconds. In order to render this in parallel, I've got a two-core machine. If I ran it in just a sequential version, you kind of see that the CPU hovers around, well, 50%, which is true. I mean, one CPU is being used. And to have a parallel version of this, well, you kind of see that there are parts of the world being split up, and the CPU usage, well, you can see a little peak up there. Both codes were being utilized. And the time was reduced from 6.5 seconds to just over 4 seconds, so over a 15% speed up. Now, what was the line of code, or the lines of code that were affected to achieve this 50% plus speed? If you notice this link query out here, the parallel version of this has only one line of code changed, which is that. So all you do is, on the source, you specify an extension method called asParallel, and, well, since a link query doesn't usually mutate data, queries by definition only select data, so you don't mutate data, so you're pretty much safe with state. So this is the kind of things that .NET 4.0 is providing. And there are some interesting features provided by the .NET 4.0 base class libraries. Now what you also see up here is there's a parallel version of the for loop. It's not a language construct. It's actually just a class with a method called for, which takes a number of parameters, and the last parameter happens to be the body of the loop. Now, a parallel for, if you just squint hard enough, and if you stare at it long enough, it doesn't look that much different than a normal for loop. But you have to stare at it hard enough. And to kind of show you some of the intelligent things that are happening with parallelization, what you see out here is a slightly different kind of construct, where now you have a couple of bouncing balls. I'm not going to spend too much time out here, but essentially there's one ball bouncing, and I've got a horrible frame rate per second, essentially just half a frame rate per second. But if I stop this and attempt to run this in parallel, since I've only got two cores, and I'm also going to show you the threads that are running out here. What you see out here on the screen now is, well, my frame rate has kind of almost doubled. But what you see with regard to the scene that's being rendered is there are two colors out there, green and red. Those are the two threads that are doing the work. But if you notice, it's also a little bit intelligent, because it's not just splitting the scene in half and handing it off to each thread. If you notice, parts of the scene are being split up and handled by different threads. So what's essentially happening out here as the ball is bouncing is that if you divide the work up equally between two threads, the chances are one thread is going to finish quicker than the rest, because, well, the scene is not equal. If one thread finishes quicker than the other one, the runtime is intelligent enough that the thread that's finished quicker goes to the thread that's busy and says, do you still have more work? And if it does, it's going to steal some of the work. And that's what you see out here. Now, these kind of things to do from a developer perspective are quite hard. But if the runtime provides you with these kind of infrastructures, then that makes the developer tasks a whole lot easier. There are a couple of sessions on the parallel extensions to the .NET framework, I think over the course of today and tomorrow. So, well, if you want more details, you should go to one of those. All right. Now that we've kind of seen what's coming a little bit in the runtime, let's now dive into C# 4.0, which is why all of you are here. All right. Well, the theme of C# 4.0 is dynamic programming. And the features are broadly split up in four categories. We've got dynamically typed objects that lets you interoperate with dynamic languages. I'll go into all of these in a little bit of detail in the upcoming slides. We've got optional and named parameters, which has been a customer request for a very long time. Also, some improved interop with Lisp. And a little bit of academic detail with regard to common contra variants. Like I said, we'll go into each of these in the upcoming slides. Now, coming to dynamic programming. So far, the common language runtime, or the CLR, has been statically typed. So, statically typed doesn't even have languages like C#, Visual Basic, .NET, but essentially all of the languages were strongly typed or statically typed. Now, the downside to having statically typed languages is that there are some parts of functionality which you want to develop where statically typed languages tend to get in your way. And what the dynamic language runtime does, the dynamic language runtime is similar to the common language runtime. The common language runtime is for statically typed languages, and the dynamic language runtime is for dynamic languages. Now, what the dynamic language runtime does is it provides a unification path between the statically typed world and the dynamic world. Now, what the dynamic language runtime provides are things like expression trees, which were introduced in .NET 3.5 or C# 3.0. Also, a mechanism to dispatch your calls to the target dynamically at runtime. So if you have a dynamic language which you want to interoperate with, well, the call has to be dispatched at runtime because you don't know at compile time what you're going to do. So there needs to be an infrastructure to be able to dispatch the call dynamically. And also, if you're dispatching calls dynamically, then that means there is an overhead associated with resolution of what you're trying to do. Now, of course, if you call a dynamic piece of functionality 1,000 times, it doesn't make sense to have the resolution also 1,000 times. So there's some kind of caching going on, which makes sure that the resolution is only done once. So if you call something 1,000 times, the resolution is done once, and then that overhead is gone. And sitting on top of the dynamic language runtime are languages like IronPython and IronRuby. Now, these are pure dynamic languages, so nothing new out here. But what is new is that statically typed languages are historically what used to be statically typed languages, like C# and Visual Basic .NET, also sit on top of the dynamic language runtime. And there could be others. And of course, what the dynamic language runtime does is it should be able to dispatch calls to whatever might be necessary. It might be .NET. It could be JavaScript. It could be Python, Ruby, or Kong. So there's a whole lot of implementations which take care of the dispatch to the right type. All right. To talk a little bit about how dynamic type objects work in the .NET world, coming to the standard example which everyone tends to use, if you've got a calculator class, you tend to see that Visual Studio gives you a whole lot of insight into the class. For example, things like the methods, the parameters, and things like that. So you would just write code like this and execute it, and it works. Now, assuming that you did not know the type of calculator, well, .NET does provide reflection. So this is the kind of code that you would write if you did not know the type. For example, you might load the type dynamically from an assembly, so at compile time, you don't know what the type is. And if you needed to invoke a certain piece of functionality, this is the kind of code you would write. Am I right in assuming most people here have written some code like this sometime in the past? Sure, thanks. So in the .NET world, when you want to do things dynamically, this is the kind of code you would have to write. Now, assuming that you needed to interoperate with JavaScript, if you were programming in Silverlight, this is the kind of code that you would have to write in Silverlight to work with JavaScript in the browser. So what you do is you kind of get a type, and of course, since the type is not known to .NET, you kind of have to do some special things where the method is specified in quotes. Now, if you look at these different programming models, these are different environments. One is .NET, the other is JavaScript. And the kind of code that you would have to write is different. So for each environment, whether it's JavaScript, .NET, Kong Interop, the kind of code that you write is all different, but no more. Now, all you have to do is write code that looks like that. Now, the beauty of this is, you see, a pseudo keyword called dynamic, what it actually does is it tells C# that the static type is dynamic. Which, if you think about it, doesn't make sense. How can you statically type something to be dynamic? But if you stare at it long enough, it makes sense. So when you statically type something to be dynamic, all of the method implications are also dynamic. And the results of a dynamic operation can also be dynamic. But if you assign them to a strongly typed return type, that conversion is also automatic. Now, the dynamic keyword is a little bit different from the var keyword in C# 3.0. The var keyword is nothing but you being lazy as a developer. The var keyword is just used because you don't want to type in the full name. That's it. From the compile time perspective, everything is statically typed. But in the case of dynamic, the compile time type is actually dynamic, but the runtime type is what's on the right-hand side. So since everything happens at runtime, well, you have no idea if things would work or not. Now, to kind of show you what happens when you call things on statically typed classes in a dynamic manner. Now, you've got the math class with a couple of methods to get the absolute value of something. In C Sharp, if you declare something to be of static type double, and you call it an overload method, what happens is the compiler checks at compile time, does such a method exist, and at compile time, a particular method is chosen. But if you use dynamic, what happens is that at compile time, nothing is known. So you could type complete gibberish, and it would work. But at runtime, it would try to figure out what it is that you're trying to do. Look at the parameters, look at the method name, and then figure out, at runtime, can I call something? And if there's a match found, it does invoke it. So two cases out there where different methods are chosen at runtime. Now, the beauty of all of this comes from a class called Dynamic Object. Now, this class is opened up, so you as a developer can also implement this kind of dynamic functionality. Now, there are some methods out here which we'll actually go into in one of the demos. But the important methods out here are things like get member, set member, and invoke member. Now, these are methods that will be invoked at runtime when you're trying to get properties, set properties, or invoke a member. To give you a quick demo of the dynamic features. Alright, what I have out here is just a simple calculator class. And of course, if I use the var keyword, like I said, that's just me being lazy out here, because if you hover your mouse over the calculator variable, you see that it's statically typed. So I have method inside, I have parameter inside, so everything continues as it does and should. But once I put in the dynamic keyword, what you tend to see with IntelliSense is it tells you that it's a flat dynamic, which means nothing works. Of course, if nothing works, well, the proof of the pudding, like they say, is in the eating. So if I run this, somewhere up there, you should see a result being printed. But also, I could type in complete gibberish. And if I now try to execute this, you get an exception. And what that exception says is, I don't know if this is readable. You kind of see no overload for method add takes 4 arguments. Get an exception. Fair enough. So, at least what you see with the dynamic types is it doesn't mean that you need to go out and change all your programs to be dynamic. There are cases where dynamic needs to be used, but for the most part, statically typed code is a good thing. Now, to give you a little bit of an idea of how this also interoperates or how C Sharp interoperates with dynamic languages, what I've got out here is a simple piece of code written in IMPython. It's exactly the same piece of code that you saw earlier. I've got a calculator class with an add method, and I have a method out here which returns a new calculator. And in order to invoke this functionality written in IMPython from C Sharp, now, this is the kind of code that I would have to write. What I do is, I new up the Python runtime from within C Sharp. And then what I can then do is, I can ask the Python runtime to give me a calculator instance. And this method is actually that one up there. Now remember that since the type is dynamic, I don't get any IntelliSense. And what I could then do is just have a loop. I could then call the add method with the parameters. And if I then execute this program, what you see is C# calling dynamically into types and functionality that it does not know about at compile time. So all of the resolution that you see out here is all deferred to runtime. Now there are some interesting side effects, because IPython is loosely typed. I could pass anything to the add method. Like for example, here I could pass not just ints, but also decimal values. And it works, because Python is loosely typed. Now it doesn't have to be numbers. It can be any type which supports a plus operator. Now for example, what I could do is I could try to say date time.today. And I want to add time span. I want to add, let's say, 10 days to today and print it out. And if I then run this piece of code, it tells me, well, that should be the 7th of June, which I think is about right. So this is how C# using the dynamic keyword actually works with or interoperates with dynamic languages. Now let's take things a little bit further and make it a bit more complicated. This is a geeky section, so you guys should be able to at least see some geeky stuff. Now what I have out here is a class that I've created called a dynamic bag. A bag is just like a dictionary where you can have key value pairs, but in this case it would be properties and values. And normally when you want to have properties and values stored, you would create a class and you would, well, define all your properties. But I want to avoid that, and what I want to do is I want to do something like this, where I kind of say new dynamic bag. And what I then want do in this is dynamically set properties. Like, for example, I can say this name is future of C#. Oh. Kind of. Have a couple of other. Then, let's add. Well, just over an hour, so. And since it's dynamic, all of these pieces of code will compile. But of course, nothing will work, because we've not implemented any functionality yet. And in addition, to be able to support properties, what I would also like to do is kind of call a method on it that says, I'm going to talk to that. C#. Well, all of these methods, of course, are unknown to this type. So if I actually try to execute this piece of code, it would give me an exception. Kind of says, okay, I don't know if you can read it, there is no definition for session name, which is true. So how do we get this support from my own custom class? Now remember that this class that I have inherits from a dynamic object. And the dynamic object provides a number of methods which I then have to implement in order to support this. So let's try again. Remember, and what this piece of code does is, this is the piece of code that will be invoked when I try to retrieve the value of a particular property. So I get some information about the property that's trying to be retrieved and what the result should be. And as a developer, I'm free to implement this in the way that I see fit. And in this particular case, what I want to do is I want to store everything in a dictionary, kind of a dictionary which has a property name and the value. And then I could just kind of say return. I could say return items dot try get value. Well, the binder that's passed to me gives me information about the property name that the developer was trying to use. And then I could kind of say, well, if I find it, I return it. And in a similar way, I could kind of implement functionality for the try set member. I would kind of say underscore items binder dot name equals the value of the spot, and because this succeeded, I would then say return a true. Now if I go back to my program, wrong one, and now try running this, well, I get a different exception, which kind of says, well, you still forgot about that method. But at least, something does work. So this does work. This doesn't work. So in this particular case, what we're going to do is, we see that these properties now tend to work, but there's nothing yet to handle methods. So I could, well, have a very trivial implementation out here. And in this one, I would say try invoke member. Now if you take a look at it, that gives me the method that was called, the arguments that were passed, and what the result of invocation should be. So out here, I could be I'm going to be very dumb out here, and all I'm going to do is I'm going to say result equals that. Well, and this succeeds. So if I go back to my program, well, since that returns what looks like a string, I should be able to pass that to string and then try executing this piece of code. And you see, well, it works. Of course, if I try to pass in something else, of which I know nothing about, well, I don't know what I should do. So in this case, I can actually check the arguments. For example, I probably should be doing a whole lot of checks out here, but I'm going to skip all of those. I'm going to say if arguments.1 as a string equals C sharp result. Oh, do I have insert on? And if I then run this program, well, I have a very trivial implementation, but it kind of gives you an idea of how you can build dynamic functionality yourself. Now, what you can also do to make things even more interesting is, I'm not going to override the string implementation, just to show you that actually this class does store all of the properties that it has. So in this case, I'm going to say return, and then I'm now going to new up a link to XML piece of code. I would say that, I would say from in underscore items, select new X element. I know. A dictionary is nothing but a key value pair. So what I have up here is a very trivial implementation. And if I go back to my program and also do a console write line of my dynamic type, what you see up here is actually all of the properties that are set. So it kind of says that was the session name, and those were the properties in the back. So dynamic types, pretty strong support. All right, coming to a feature which has been requested quite a lot by a customer is the support for named and optional parameters. A very, very powerful feature. And what you see on screen is actually a method which takes quite a few parameters. Now, this happens to be... Oh. That's not what I wanted. All right, where is I? Okay. All right, what I have here is a method which happens to be the primary method or your calling point into your application. But because the method has a number of parameters, what you would like to do is provide some easy ways to call into this functionality. So as a developer, what you tend to do is you tend to provide a few overloads, which will then call the primary method with certain default values. Right? So when you have all of these different overloads, well, again, things start to get confusing because a typical method could have any number of overloads. But optional and named parameters get around this in a pretty elegant way. Now, the way you could use optional and named parameters is in the declaration of the method, you could specify that parameters are optional by specifying the values right then and there. So what you see is the encoding has a default value of null, and a boolean has a default value of true, and a buffer size has been specified in the declaration of the method. Which means that the caller of the method only has to specify the parameters which are not optional, or the mandatory parameters, which would be the first one, the path. And then the rest he can skip or choose. So he could write this invoking code in this way. Or you could skip certain parameters and also specify the name of the parameter in the call itself. Okay, then why would I want to specify the name of the parameter in the call itself? I've never done that. Why should I do it now? Well, I would argue that if you did that, kind of documents your code as well. Now, if you just see a 4096 number up there, what's the first thing as a developer that you're going to do? F12 to the method definition, or kind of hit Control Shift Space to kind of get the method inside and figure out what is that 4096 doing up here. You need to figure it out. But if you have a named parameter, well, you kind of see, all right, I look at it, I know what it means. It's a buffer size name. And because you can specify named arguments, it also means you can screw up your code by specifying things out of order, just to make things confusing. You can, it's valid, and it works. So all of the arguments can be specified in any order that you wish, if all of them are named. And of course, because they appear in a specific order, it also means they're also evaluated in the order that you specify. So if there are any exceptions, when you set certain values, then you will get the exceptions in the order that you wrote them. Alright, so that was about option and name parameters. I'll kind of combine this with com interop. How many of you here deal with com interop? How many of you have written code like this? Way too many of you. But all of this was necessary because the com world is quite different from your managed world. So you had to do things like this to just get something as simple as saving a file working. If you had to interop with com from C sharp, you don't need this anymore. Starting with C sharp 4.0, this code can be replaced with that. So for those of you who work with com, it only took Microsoft 10 years to fix it. But we're there. So what com interop does is, it provides an automatic mapping when you use com types to use the dynamic keyword. And of course, there's heavy use of option and name parameters up here. And also a feature which you kind of see on the last bullet point. When you interoperate with com, you have the primary interop assemblies, PIA, also a pain in the whatever. But the primary interop assemblies normally create a whole lot of problems because the primary interop assemblies may or may not be present on the machines where things are deployed. Now, if you, for example, interoperate with Excel, you need the interop assemblies for Excel installed on the machine where you want it to work. And that kind of creates a whole lot of problems because users may or may not have those assemblies installed, may or may not have the right version of the assemblies. So it's a whole lot of headaches. But with type embedded, you can choose for the interop assemblies to be embedded as a part of your application. So your application bundles the primary interop assemblies along with it, but not as a separate assembly, but the types are extracted from the interop assemblies and pumped into your assembly. All right, to give you a demo of what the com interop looks like. This is the one part where the amount of code that I had to write was too much, so I'm not going to type it in like I did before. What you see out here is a piece of code which opens up Excel. That part, and then it adds a workbook and sets two columns in that, one to be the process name and a memory usage. This is my version of the task manager in Excel. And what I do up here is I write a link query which goes through the system type diagnostics, the process class, gets the processes running on my machine, takes the top 10 processes according to the memory use, and then puts them in an Excel sheet. But if you look at the code for putting things in Excel sheets or dealing with Excel from C sharp, the com interop is kind of a pain in the whatever. You kind of see that I have a whole lot of castings because everything that's returned from the interop side of things is just, if I, for example, choose to go for cells. That's, for some reason, my method itself doesn't work, but essentially, that, okay, it does. Yeah. And what you see out there is everything returns now things to be of type dynamic. But if I didn't have this, then I would have to have a whole lot of costs and then set a number of values, and then you kind of see a whole range of type missings out there, and I kind of then create a chart in Excel just to show you what this program does. Just going to execute it, and you should see Excel startup. Visual Studio takes up, but that's no surprise. All right, so here I have a piece of Excel intro. And now the beauty of the dynamic type is that I could just replace that one keyword with that, and then I can clean up a whole lot of my code. Because now I don't need all of this junk, if you will. I can skip a whole lot of that. I can also skip that. By the way, if I've made any mistakes in my code, then I don't need to do anything. Oh yeah. Background IntelliSense. All right, and this again is probably not needed. I'm just kind of removing a whole lot of things that I think are a complete waste of. All right. Let me just see if IntelliSense. Oh, I think my IntelliSense refused to work. But anyway, I had a backup, which was to show you the code a little bit down there. I could have done this in the beginning, which I should have. But what you see out here is the use of optional and named parameters. So you kind of see that I can skip a whole of the type missings and just add the source and the title up there. And this is the code for interoperating with com. And this is how the code should have looked like in the first place, not with all of the costs that are needed. And so, like I said, it took Microsoft 10 years, but we're there. All right. Now, a little bit of language theory. I won't spend too much time on co and contra variants, but I'll spend a little bit of time here and instead tell you what it means for you as a developer. Now, with co and contra variants, this could be just .NET 1.0 or whatever code. What I have out here is an array of string. And if I then call a process method which accepts a parameter of type object of string, this would compile and this would work in all versions of .NET. Because a string does inherit from an object. I mean, a string is an object. So I can actually convert an array of string to an array of object. And things do work. But I can also do funny things where I could cause runtime exceptions to happen. Because I have an array of object, it means I can put in something which is not, well, a string out there. And this would compile, but at runtime, I would get an exception. So arrays in .NET are covariant, which means they can be converted to a less derived type. But they're not safely covariant. Now, if you try to do something like what you see on the screen, now I'm not dealing with arrays, but now I'm dealing with a generic type list, which has strings in it, and I call a process method, which takes an enumerable of object, you would expect this code to compile and work. But up until .NET 4.0, this piece of code would refuse to compile. The compiler would give you an exception saying, could not find a type conversion from list of string to an enumerable of object. And that's because in .NET, till version 4.0, generics were invariant. So generics did not support covariancy. But C-sharp 4.0, this piece of code actually would compile under C-sharp 4.0. But only under certain conditions. And the condition is that for this conversion to happen, it's a safe conversion because an IEnumerable is read-only. There's no way you can pop in data into an IEnumerable. You can into a list, but you can't into an IEnumerable. And if that's the case, then the conversion does succeed. I'm also running a little bit short on time, so I'm going to skip a couple of things pretty quickly and then I think jump to what's important for you guys. Well, this is the support for covariancy. I'll just talk about what covariancy is and what it's not. Now, what covariancy lets you do is if you have an I-enumerable of string, you can convert that to an I-enumerable of object. So you can treat things as less derived in a safe manner. That's covariancy in a nutshell. And similarly, the reverse may apply in certain cases, but only in certain cases. Like, for example, you have the comparer interface, which has a method which can compare two values. Now, if I have a comparer, like you see on the bottom of the screen, where I can compare two objects, that is just two generic objects, then it should be possible for me to use that same thing against something that can compare strings. Whether the result will be correct or not is a different issue, but I should be able to use something as more derived in certain cases. And that's contravariance. But what does this mean for you, the developer? It means that a whole lot of things that didn't compile before but left you scratching your head, why doesn't this work, now works. So that's the bottom line for you as a developer. If you're a language geek, then some of this stuff is interesting. But also, co and contravariance in C#4.0 is only supported for interfaces. So you will not find them on things like, for example, lists, or any of the classes. So it's only on interfaces and delegate types. And there are certain rules when things can and cannot be covariant. Like, for example, value types are always invariant. And if you use parameters which are ref or out, well, they're also invariant. And here's a short list of interfaces and delegates which support safe co and contravariancy. Alright, so that was all about C#4.0, which kind of covered most of the features. Let's talk about what's coming afterwards. Well, what's coming afterwards is always hard to predict. It's always hard to look into the future. But some of the things that, some of the trends that we see have to do with metaprogramming. Now, what is metaprogramming? Now, typically, code that you tend to write has just been static. Now, raise your hand if you've ever used code generation in any project where you had to generate code based on a database or some kind of metadata that you would define somewhere. Now, all of that, again, tends to be static. That is, you emit your code, and then if it's C# code, well, you compile it, you run it through the compiler. But up until now, metaprogramming has not really taken off. Metaprogramming is nothing but the ability of a program to get a representation of itself so it can modify itself at runtime. It sounds pretty cool. I'll show you a demo of that in a little bit. So metaprogramming is becoming pretty popular. And up until now, the compiler has been pretty much a black box. That is, you have your source files, you pass it to the compiler, and, well, you kind of get an assembly. But the compiler has been a black box in the sense you never had an idea what the hell is the compiler doing. Can I hook into things? Can I maybe do things on my own? And now what we are thinking of doing is opening up that box so as a developer, you can get insight into what the compiler is doing. So for example, you could figure out, well, there's a class, what kind of attributes are there on it, what are the fields declared on it. And this lets you do things like metaprogramming and embedding it yourselves and defining your own object model. Now, to give you a demo of how this black box opened up looks like, this is compiler as a service where your program can add or modify functionality as and when you see fit. Now, this is something of a bit of a sneak preview because it's not there. Because it's after C#4.0. We don't have C#4.0 yet. So after C#4.0 is definitely not there. Alright. What I have out here is a simple class which uses a new term. It's actually just a shortcut for evaluating programs at runtime. Now what the C# evaluator class does is actually maybe not that interesting. But it does have a reference to a C# compiler which provides a number of functionalities to compile your code from within your application. So what does this mean? What this means is that this is my C# code, my main method. I could kind of do something like every program must have users, so I kind of have that. And then what I could then do is evaluate a program. Now, what can this program be? It can be anything. Kind of say for int I equals 0, I less than 10, I plus plus, and then console right line I star I. Does this program kind of look complete? Well, kind of looks complete. And if I set that as my startup project, and if I then execute this piece of code, this is actually my C# program, where within my C# programming I'm defining and compiling code on the fly, which is executing in the same process space as my application. Pretty cool stuff, I think. And there's a whole lot of things you can do. So here I've just had a little loop up here, but what I could also do is, for example, I could define a method out here, which takes what I do out here is I define a method which takes in a value and then returns the square of that. And then what I could do is I could call into that saying let me actually print something out. Console write line. And then I would say square of 20. Alright. And what I'm doing out here is declaring a function and invoking that function. And if I then run this piece of code, see that. Which is cool. And you think, well, you're just defining strings, but you know, how do I kind of get into this from my program? Well, there are some tricks that you can do. For example, to invoke this piece of functionality from within your code, what you could do is just going to add a few more. I think there are quite a few more usings that I need out here. References. I need to add a reference to a func type out here, which you've probably all used in .NET 3.5. And then what I could then do is get a reference to this guy that I defined out here. So I could say func, which takes an int, and an int. That's int as a parameter, int as a return type, f equals func. And I need to perform a cast. And I could say evaluator.eval. Say new func int int. And then pass it a reference to small correction. I need to get the results out there. And then what I could then do is now I have a function which is defined in C#, and that's going to be cast from something that I've defined at runtime. So which means at compile time, I should then be able to invoke a function like so. I define things dynamically, but statically I can still get a reference to it. Now this also means you can do a whole lot of things which are pretty cool, which I'm going to just kind of... I had a piece of code up here which I wanted to show you, where you could then... essentially what this does is it prints things to the console. I'll maybe show you what this looks like when I run it. What I have here is a little prompt, which is my application, and then I could type in anything that I want up here. Snippets of code which I will go through, so I think I just have about a few seconds left. Oh, what I could also do is do some interesting things like this. Hey, I have a form. I could add a background image to that. And then let me also kind of add a button to that. Oh, there it is. And I could add some code that kind of print something out when you hit. Let's see. Well, that kind of also brings me to the end of the talk. If you have any questions, feel free. I'm here for today and tomorrow, so if you don't want to ask in this room, just jump in and I'm going to be walking around here.